Thank you so very much, Mr. Chairman, and good evening, friends. It is my very real happiness to be here in Auckland and to greet so many friends and members of the Theosophical Society in this very beautiful country of New Zealand, to which I must say I've already lost my heart. So while this is my first visit, I am very certain it will be by no means my last, and therefore I hope that I will remain in your good graces by the end of the evening and may return on many occasions. Our topic, our subject tonight, is one that is certainly of very real, widespread interest all over the world. In fact, I know of no country, and certainly none that I have been visiting around the world in recent years, where the subject of psychism, psychic research, extrasensory perception, parapsychology, whatever term you wish to use, that involves some kind of recognition of phenomena beyond the physical, is not of vital interest. All of us have, to some extent, some ability along these lines, as I shall try to indicate in my remarks. And so this current interest in psychic phenomena, it seems to me, is paralleling the developments in technology, in science, as man explores further and further into the reaches of space, outer space, involving himself in attempting to understand the nature of the planetary system in which we are embedded, as we probe the nature of the creative possibilities in the galaxies. There is also brought about, I think, a thrust inwards, a realization that somehow we have to also come to terms with ourselves, that it is not enough to come to terms with the moon and Mars and Jupiter and whatever lies beyond, if we have not ultimately come to terms with our own essential nature. That whatever conflicts exist outside us, whatever problems that we are confronted with, which confront us very, very much today, problems all about us of war, of poverty, of pollution, that these are also mirrored in our own nature in terms of the warring conflicts within us, in terms of the poverty of the spirit which we are experiencing, and the pollution of our mental and emotional atmosphere, which certainly parallels the external pollution of the air and waters about us. And that unless we can come to terms with ourselves, therefore, we are not likely to come to terms with each other and with the world. And so this evening I would like to explore with you something of what it means to come to terms with an understanding of these two great areas of our nature, the psychic and what is meant by that, and this deeper spiritual hunger that drives us to find answers or to try to find answers to what life is all about. The genuine search for an experience. I think this is particularly true for many young people today who are seeking a genuine, personal, spiritual experience. Not what someone else has said, for we are no longer content to just listen to what others have said. But we must know for ourselves and know in a vital way what life is all about. Does it have some deeper meaning? For this, I think we need to understand what consciousness is. How do we know? And how do we know what we know? When we say, I know something, what are we saying? What do we mean by it? When we say, can we know? Can I know? Can I know for myself? What are we talking about? What do we mean by this knowing? Well, I would like to suggest tonight that some of the insights into and researches into modern psychology, particularly modern depth psychology, coupled with the insights of an ageless wisdom which has been re-presented to the modern world under the name of theosophy, that these two combined enable us to understand every event and experience within the range of consciousness, that they help us to look at ourselves. And until we can look at ourselves honestly, openly, we can scarcely look at others and at the world. That we're all searching for meaning. Man was meant to know. And we are all searching for some kind of meaning. And so for this, I would like to postulate three hypotheses for your consideration. Just suggest them to you, and then attempt to suggest how these may work out in our search for meaning, in our search to know. First of all, that most people have what are commonly called psychic abilities or psychic powers. These are not the possession of a favored few. They do not mark spiritual evolution or the moral character of an individual, but that almost all of us, and probably every human being, if he really looks at himself, does possess psychic power. That these powers, therefore, are real and are concerned with definite realities, although they are not physical in nature. But they are real insofar as they exist at the level at which they take place. And therefore, third, for our own health, physical, bodily, and psychic, emotional, and mental health, we need to understand these powers, their origin, and the manner in which they can be consciously directed. Now, we are all conscious, at least I hope that for the period that I may be speaking this evening, you will endeavor to remain conscious. I've often said I really have no objection if you want to go to sleep, because that also is a kind of consciousness. Consciousness continues, and it's quite all right if you prefer, and if my voice becomes boring to you. There is a film coming, at least there's something interesting coming afterwards, you see, to keep you here. It's always interesting. It's a good show. It's rather dramatic, so please stay and see the movie. So I don't mind if you go to sleep. The only thing I do mind is if you snore, because that can be rather disruptive. I also have one other little thing that I mind, and you might just as well know about it, and that is that if you fall asleep and you suddenly wake up and look at your watch, don't shake it to see if it's still running. So with that little bit of warning, we can proceed with the fact that we are all conscious. Now, what we are conscious of may differ from individual to individual. But we are all conscious. The Theosophical Society postulates, therefore, that each one of us operates in a threefold field. We are very much aware of this end of the field. We are anchored here in a physical body. And we generally have a certain attachment for this physical body. We develop, in the course of the years, quite a definite feeling about the physical body. It is ours, poor thing, but it is my own. It has certain dimension. Sometimes we prefer not to talk about that. Sometimes we develop it in strange and wondrous ways, these dimensions, in which we try to reach out and embrace everything, and the body begins to take on a kind of circular shape, therefore. But whatever we do with it, we manage to feel quite attached to it. We identify often with it in very unique ways. We recognize that it is different from every other physical body and every other physical object. We generally do not confuse the physical body with other objects. And this is very important when we come into these other spheres of consciousness, psychic particularly. For example, your body has, as I say, a rather definite shape. Sometimes you may feel it's shapeless, but it has a definite shape. You do not confuse it with the chair on which you're seated. At least I hope you don't. You're not, in other words, sort of flowing over and into the chair so that when you stand up at the end this evening, the chair does not go with you. It remains, and I presume you would prefer that the chairs remain. So please know the difference. Now, there are times, and I would like to stress this, because there are times when we get confused over this. Have you ever said, for example, this chair is uncomfortable? Have you ever said that? Well, now, this is utter nonsense, and this is confusing the issue, because there is no such thing as an uncomfortable chair. A chair is simply a chair. What is uncomfortable is your relation to the chair. And that has nothing to do with the chair, but it has to do with your contours, the contours of the physical body. Now, you see, we can look at it very easily from this point of view, can't we? And we can see how ridiculous it is to say this is an uncomfortable chair. Because the chair is simply being a chair. It is neither comfortable nor uncomfortable. The chair is just a chair. Have you ever talked with a chair and asked it if it was comfortable or uncomfortable? You see, the chair is just a chair. Now, when we move into subtler areas of consciousness, confusion gets a little more real because the subtleties of difference are not so exact as here at the physical level where you and the chair are quite separate identities. In any event, you do have the physical body and you are anchored here, a body that is your inheritance from the past, an inheritance from the animal kingdom, a body with five physical senses fairly well developed, means for perceiving the objective physical world, so that we can say chair and table and person and movie screen and all sorts of things, flowers and all the rest, so that we identify these. But this is not the individual. This anchorage here is simply that which we move about. You get it up in the morning, sometimes with a certain amount of struggle, bathe it, clothe it, feed it, send it off to work, whether it wants to or not. You move the body about. You tell it what it will do. At night, you haul it home again, feed it, undress it, and put it to bed, if you're tender and loving at least, and let it have its proper care and sleep and all the rest. But you have done this. So it is postulated that there is another end of this scale, of perceptivity. Man is rooted in a reality that is not physical, that is immaterial, non-material. Man is rooted in an energy field to which has been given the name spirit. Man essentially abides in that energy field from which he periodically moves out, possessing vehicles appropriate for his needs and capacities and his future development, further evolution. Between these two fields in which man is rooted and in which man is anchored, rooted in the self, the immortal spirit, anchored here in the physical during incarnation, perceptivity, consciousness, moves along this scale. And at every point on that, where it is conscious at the moment, this vast middle area may be called the psyche, the soul, mind. And this may shift, as we will see, from concern with physical things to concern with emotional and mental conditions to concern with creative, intuitive, mystical illuminations. And we cannot confuse the physical realities with which we deal, chairs and tables and the furniture of the world, with those mystical illuminations that can transform our lives, nor can we confuse those two with this broad middle ground of psychic phenomena, because this also is quite distinct. And so the difference between psychic phenomena, including all the forms of extrasensory perception, and true spiritual vision or intuition, the genuine spiritual experience which so many people today are seeking, the genuine hunger of the spirit for meaningfulness, for significance, the difference is just as great as between the realities of the physical world and those realities of the mental and emotional nature, which are psychism. And only on a correct understanding of man can we base a recognition of the areas of the functioning of consciousness. We all recognize, for example, that physical sense perception is meaningless without some interpretation by the mind. We could, of course, go around the world, go about in the world like cattle, tasting the salt licks of the world, just gathering sensations. But we always want to know, what is it? What does that mean? If we see an object for the first time, our immediate question is, what is it? And once somebody says it's, you know, a dodecahedron, we say, ah, yes. Now, we may have the vaguest notion what a dodecahedron is, but if somebody tells us that what we're looking at is a dodecahedron, we say yes, as though there's been a flash of illumination. Of course, we may go around to our friend and say, do you know what a dodecahedron is? Have you ever heard of that? And so on. But we're afraid to reveal our ignorance, so we say, ah, yes, as long as something has a name to it, we feel content. We could, of course, call the world a collection of thingamajigs. We could just give, you know, a number to everything. Every new object, every chair, for example, would have its own unique number. But we don't. Man synthesizes. We look at objects as diverse as a straight back chair, an easy chair, a lounge chair, a rocking chair, and an oversized bean bag, which passes for a chair. And we call them all chairs. We unite them into one and say all of these are chairs, and it makes it easier for us. Now, we can misinterpret. We can meet an object, come up against an object, and say that is a chair, and someone else will come along and say, no, that really isn't a chair. It may look like a chair. It may have certain characteristics of chairness, but it is not. Now, if you will notice this, that, and the other, you will see that it is a table, not a chair. And so we misinterpret, and we can misinterpret what happens in the physical world. Ask any three people who have been witness to an accident to describe the accident. Our courts are full of cases of misinterpretation of what they saw, isn't that right? Constantly. Now, therefore, just to see beyond the physical with senses that are not the physical senses does not suddenly endow an individual with infallible understanding, with a correct interpretation. To perceive beyond the senses does not give any added insight, and therefore can be just as subject to misinterpretation as anything that we view here in the physical realm. But spiritual vision or intuition is something wholly other that no longer has to do with the perception of objective realities, whether those realities be physical or psychical, and therefore cannot be subject to the same kind of misinterpretation, to any misinterpretation, because it is that illumination that pervades the mind from another source of reality, as it were, from an interior reality in which the mind is no longer objectively looking at something, but in which the mind itself has been transformed by an interior light. And one says, I know. As Dr. Carl Jung, the great Swiss psychologist, was once asked, do you believe in God? And his answer was, no, I do not believe because I know. And this is that kind of illumination in which belief is irrelevant. Vision is irrelevant. Whether one sees chairs or auras is irrelevant. You see, we don't go around the world being very proud that we can see chairs and automobiles and people, do we? But suddenly, if we see colors around a person, or if we have seen in dream some foreknowledge of an event about to happen, or if we hear voices where there have been no physical presences speaking, we suddenly feel that somehow something has happened to us. How utterly ridiculous and how nonsensical. Unless it has in some way transformed us. I know people have rushed up to me after lectures and said, did you know you had this or that color around you? And I said, well, I hope so. I earnestly hope so, because every individual has an aura and is generally seen in terms of color. And I hope I am still in physical incarnation. And therefore, I trust that there is an aura about me. And it probably has that color. But if you were looking at that, you were scarcely listening to what I was trying to say. And so what? Everybody has an aura. So what's unique? You know, everybody has a physical body that's in incarnation. And so everyone has an aura. So what's different about that, so to speak, you see? And stop peeping, you know. looking at it. Well, now, turning for a moment to digress briefly in order to present some ideas that mesh with this concept of the theosophical view of man as tripartite in his whole realm of consciousness, from physical through psychic to spiritual, let us look at how consciousness functions, the psyche functions, according to Jungian psychology. Dr. Carl Jung and his successors, in examining the whole realm of consciousness, suggested that the psyche of man differentiates itself along certain particular lines. That consciousness, in other words, differentiates itself along lines which may be compared to the axial structure of crystals. Just as all crystalline structure follows certain patterns, for example, there are only 14 patterns in crystallography. Lines of energy, force, along which crystals form, so for the psyche of man, there are four cardinal functions which serve to orient consciousness with relation to the outer and the inner worlds. These functions are extremely interesting and help us, really, in understanding ourselves and each other. The two major functions are thinking and feeling. Consciousness moves out, as it were, along a line, one direction of which leads towards thinking. And we all know people who are predominantly thinkers. They are analytical, they are reasonable, they are rational. They are always saying, what does that mean and how does it fit in and what is the theory behind it and can you prove it and what is the evidence for it? Now, opposite that, consciousness moves out towards feeling. And we all know people who say, well, I don't care whether it makes sense or not, it feels good, you know. And I don't care whether it's true or not, all that matters is that it's good. These are people who respond through feeling. Now, this broad area of thinking, feeling, as man operates in this, develops into the rational, because feeling also is rational, the rational functions of which give us reflection, so that everything that happens to us in the world, every circumstance, every event, is filtered, as it were, through this realm of reflection. We really do not wholly think or wholly feel. And this is why I have long been an advocate of a new word to be added to the English language. Someday it will appear in dictionaries, and you will all remember that Joy Mills, a theosophical lecturer, gave this word to the world. We flink. Isn't that a good word? We don't just think or feel, we flink. Because all of us are constantly flinking. I don't just think. My thinking is mixed up with feeling. And I don't just feel. My feeling is mixed up with thinking. So isn't it easier to say we flink? Now remember that. We flink. But this broad area of reflection is our flinking that's going on all the time. Even as I speak, you are flinking about it. Aren't you? You're responding in some way. First, perhaps thinking, then feeling, and so on. All of this. Now, opposed to these two functions are functions that have to do with the world external to us. This is the broad inner realm of reflection. But we also have a function of sensation and a function of intuition, which relate us immediately to the world outside us. Because even intuition is of things beyond the normal range of consciousness, reaching into another sphere. Now, very much can be said about these functions, but I'm not going to go into them in detail. They are extremely interesting to see how they operate and how they are developed in various individuals. We all know people, for example, who are always living in tomorrow, who are always saying this will happen, who are visionaries. These are the intuitive people of the world. We all know individuals who want it right now, who want to sense something immediately, who want to feel and touch and somehow come close to the world in its immediacy. These are the sensation types. We all know the people, as I say, who are content with moods, who are looking to the past, the good old days, who live a kind of circular existence. The way things were yesterday was always better than the way things are today. These are the feeling, predominantly feeling types. We all know the cold, analytical, rationalistic type. These are the purely thinking types. But we're all a mixture of them. Now, along with this, there is another aspect of consciousness which we ought to look at momentarily. And this is the aspect of consciousness which Gestalt psychology has been investigating, discovering that every individual has, as part of his equipment, as it were, in consciousness, innate tendencies to structure the material given. Gestalt psychology, for example, has demonstrated the existence of a group, an innate group of organizing influences, structuring tendencies which are due to past experiences and learned associations. Now, these organizing tendencies in consciousness, through this broad realm of reflection, are extremely important when we come to consider psychic phenomena, because one of the very grave risks in prematurely or violently, through drugs or other methods, through the wrong use of yogic procedures and so on, the grave risk in prematurely or violently tearing open the brain consciousness to psychic perceptivity is that, as has been well documented, the structuring tendencies themselves can be destroyed. These unconscious organizing principles, innate and learned, have been most demonstrated with respect to vision and to hearing. For example, you can hear three notes and immediately recognize God Save the Queen. If you hear the first three notes, isn't that right? You immediately stand up, you say. You can hear three notes and immediately begin to waltz because you know it's the beginning of the Blue Danube, perhaps. You can hear a voice on a telephone and immediately know who that belongs to, can't you? At once. This innate structuring tendency out of memory, out of learned associations, do you see, works almost automatically. And with regard to seeing, you need to see only a part of an object to immediately identify the whole object. You see a tail, a furry tail, waving about. And you say, that's a cat. Now, you haven't seen the cat, but you know enough about cats to identify the whole object from seeing just a part of it. Now, because, interestingly enough, because these organizing principles seem to be most in evidence through vision and hearing, their breakdown also, particularly through the use of drugs, has become most apparent in these two areas. So that the individual who has prematurely attempted in some manner to gain psychic perceptivity may live wholly in a fantasy world, unable to deal with reality, unsure whether what he sees is a physical object or a psychic object, and therefore is confused and no longer able to deal with physical things because he can no longer distinguish between physical and psychic realities, or he hears voices constantly and can no longer distinguish meaning. And I can only say that out of my own experience in meeting individuals who have suffered this kind of breakdown, there is no greater tragedy in the world, I think, than this kind of tragedy in which there has been an effort through some forced awakening to gain psychic abilities, thinking that that will somehow solve and be the panacea for all one's ills. And it's only, as it were, turned on the tap, and the individual doesn't know how to turn it off, and therefore is flooded from the unconscious. It is as though there is a rent, a visible rent in this realm of reflection, so that there is no longer any control. Thought and feeling, therefore, reflection, are all the time playing upon the field of perceptivity, unless, as I've suggested, we deliberately cut the link of conscious, rational thought feeling. Some mental disorders, for example, are clearly the result of the severance of the organizing processes from the perceptive processes. Experiences under some of the hard drugs are also a reorganization of sensory material into new patterns, presumably due to the chemical action, the biochemical action of the drug on the cerebral organizing mechanisms, and consequently can and often have produced breakages in the axial structure of consciousness, similar to the geological breakage known as a fault, which results in the upthrust known as an earthquake. And psychic earthquakes can and have occurred and produce a total severance of the physical personality from the immortal self. And so I think it is not too strong a statement to suggest that the premature hankering after psychic ability through the use of drugs or improper yogic methods is psychic suicide. Now, for this recognition, therefore, it is suggested that it is useful to realize that consciousness has its own protective devices. Consciousness has its own protective devices, just as here a physical body separates us from the rest of the world and yet joins us in a way through the openness of the pores of the skin to warmth and light and heat and all the rest. Still, it separates us conveniently from other physical objects. So there is an appropriate mechanism, a bridge mechanism, between the physical realm and the psychic. And this bridge mechanism has been called the etheric, which can be rent and therefore, as it were, permit an inrush into the physical brain consciousness when it is rent, when it is torn violently, of a flooding from the unconscious, which can and has led to insanity. Now, in this, I think we have to recognize, therefore, that what we are talking about essentially, in terms of psychic perceptivity, properly controlled, is an integral part of the mechanism of the human mind. An integral part. It is not some unique capacity reserved for a few divinely elected individuals. We are talking really here about faculties that are a carryover from our animal heritage. For psychic faculties are simply an inheritance from our own animal inheritance, from that heritage of the evolutionary stages. Faculties that no more mark our spiritual evolution than does our ability to drive a car, or does it indicate that our moral character is any better than our ability to read a book, as it were. There is really a considerable overlapping, because this bridge mechanism is a very tenuous mechanism, a considerable overlapping between the physical and the psychic levels. If I observe my friend, for example, I may notice that his smile has faded, shoulders drooped, but if I can go further and see, actually see his thoughts and feelings, then I may know that he is in a state of depression. So it is all the way from this simple feeling of perceptivity, a simple awareness. Have you ever entered a room in which you immediately felt at home, at ease? Have you ever met a person with whom you felt at once, at one, as though you could share with that individual something deep and meaningful? Have you ever entered a room in which you knew that something violent had occurred there, you were ill at ease, you were uncomfortable, could hardly wait to get out of there? These are all aspects of this psychic perceptivity. Now, of course, I cannot, and there isn't time, to explore all of the phenomena that are included under this general term of psychic phenomena, or parapsychology, or ESP, such phenomena as psychokinesis, telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, all of the phenomena up to those of trained and positive psychism. But the one point that I would like to make is that there is one characteristic common to all psychic phenomena, and it is just that, phenomenalistic. All of it is therefore dealing with externals, with viewing, as it were, seeing, either with or without physical perception, because psychic perception is but another aspect of physical perception, just an extension. It is viewing that which is external and is therefore in the realm of the phenomenal or the realm of appearances. Real in its own way, but no more real at its level than is this chair at its level. Where the scientist today, the physical scientist, tells us that chair is merely a whirling mass of atoms moving at such a rate that it gives the illusion of solidity. And so this characteristic must be kept in mind. It is all phenomenalistic. It is not dealing with the reality of things. And so here we must now take a real leap and recognize that the mind which perceives, whether at the psychic or the physical level, is itself only a vesture of an indwelling self. That the psyche, as the mental, emotional nature or field of consciousness, is rooted in a more fundamental reality, a universal field of energy to which a number of names have been given. One of the foremost of Jungian analysts, for example, Dr. Erich Neumann, has spoken of the essential nature of man not as Homo sapiens, the thinking being, but Homo mysticus, mystical man, man rooted in a supreme reality of the noumenal. And that great Catholic scientist, Théo de Chardin, has spoken of the point which he terms Omega, in which all the radii of the world meet, a center radiating at the core of a system of centers. Now, the possibility of this leap to a recognition of a self behind or beyond the psyche, of a transcendent immortal spirit beyond the mind consciousness, is suggested whenever consciousness moves along that axial structure which is termed intuition. Whether through meditation or study, whether in moments of supreme silence or in the midst of a roaring crowd, the multitude, we move inwards to that reality which is no longer content with the appearances of things, whether psychic or physical, but with the reality of life itself. We have moved to the genuine spiritual experience. And I suggest that only in opening that road inwards can we come to the true spiritual experience, the transforming experience that never leaves us alone again. All of us are, as was Saul walking the road to Damascus, argumentative, skeptical, concerned with the personal self, involved in his own private world. The experience that overtook him and made him Paul, the carrier of a new consciousness, can overtake each one of us if we will. And it can cause then a mutational rebirth for which reincarnation is simply an external evidence of an internal reality of a rebirth that can take place at every moment of time. One does not have to wait for lives, for incarnations, ad nauseam, ad infinitum. But this very moment you can walk out of here a new person, open wide to the world, because you are no longer content with seeing chairs as chairs, or auras as auras, or hearing voices, whether on the telephone or over waves that are not visible, through clairvoyance, telepathy, all the rest, moving tables without any physical means of levitation and all the rest of it. Because now you have come face to face with a reality. What a difference it would make if we could, all of us, look at each other from the point of view of this reality. See not in front of us physical bodies or auras surrounding them with all of the coruscating colors of the psychic realm. But if instead, when we looked at every individual in the world, when we meet each other, as we walk down a street, wherever we may be, if we could look into the heart of each other, see with eyes of love and compassion and understanding, and awaken the essential God in each individual, because all we have seen is the face of God wherever we look. What a world this would be! How transformed! And the psychic playthings would be set aside as much as the physical playthings of our childhood. No longer content to play about in the murky realm of the psyche any more than in the misleading realm of the physical world. For we now perceive wholly, beautifully, perceive, as Blake put it, a world in a grain of sand and eternity in an hour. The mind turned inwards in meditation. The mind controlled, quiet, unruffled by the play of emotions, can invoke the spiritual experience, although sometimes it comes unbidden in utter stillness. Knowledge direct, immediate, complete. Is this not what our world needs? The hunger and poverty of the spirit demands no less of each of us, that having once perceived the reality of things, we are no longer content with the appearances of things. That having perceived for one moment the vision of the divine, our lives are changed, and we can no longer be content to move as normally we have before, to move about jealous, petty, silly, stupid. And these are the things psychic experiences leave us just as stupid and silly and petty and annoying and irritating as before, sometimes more so, because we always have to talk about our psychic experiences, you know, as though they were something unique and unusual. The genuine spiritual experience changes us, leaves us as never before, and we now view the world in a new manner, for everything in the world becomes a symbol, a part of the numinous, the world prodigiously pregnant with God and the godly. For when there is light within us, the world is light. And when there is darkness within us, when we are concerned with our own seeing, physical or psychic, the world outside becomes dark and opaque, and an unhappy place. It is only as the light shines from within, illumined by that inner reality, when we become the light, as it were, that we bring light to our world, and the problems outside which we have created are now solved. Spiritual vision and the true spiritual experience leads to that transformation that makes the person less personal, less concerned with himself. Not, you should know about my experience, but rather, I greet that in you which is divine, and call forth from you that which is light and beautiful and holy, because it is whole. The genuine spiritual experience leaves us gentler, kinder, more patient, more loving. And so let us not be content with phenomena, physical or psychic, but only answer that call of the immortal spirit. As an ancient sage once wrote, "Can you walk on water? You have done no better than a straw. Can you fly in the air? You have done no better than a bluebottle." Conquer your heart, then you may become somebody. And I would like to add to that, because then it doesn't matter whether you're anybody at all.